Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. In this episode, we feature a panel from our book festival from November 2017 called Questions, Interrogations, and Confessions, Making Life into Art. It featured poets Kaveh Akbar, Melissa Phoebos, Megan Steelstra, and was moderated by Marissa Siegel from The Rumpus. For these three poets, writing has saved their lives, quite literally. They have taken trauma or addiction or other extreme experiences and processed them through the medium of poetry. By doing so, they've created the distance or understanding they needed to carry on their lives. What is remarkable is that while that process clearly had therapeutic value, they've managed to turn that process into art of the highest order. Their work is searing and beautiful and unapologetic, without a hint of melodrama, cliche, or self-pity. Once you hear it, you will not forget it. A quick note to our listeners, portions of this episode contain mature themes and may not be suitable for all audiences. Here's moderator Marissa Siegel.
We are here to talk about writing through and about our trauma and pain, and how do we do that? Why do we do that? When do we do that? But before we talk about that, we're going to start with some readings from these awesome writers. Why don't we just go down the line? So Megan, you want to kick that off?
Sure. Hi, thanks for having me. I just peed on the stick and now I have to wait 3 minutes. It's 7:25 and 14 seconds, and according to the instructions on the box, in 3 minutes, either a plus sign or a minus sign will appear in the little window, which means by 7:28 and 14 seconds, I'll know if my entire life just changed. It's funny how time plays tricks on you. 1 second, I'm a freshman at a nice Midwestern university with a nice Midwestern boyfriend, and then I get a scholarship to study in Italy, so here I am in Rome, meeting people from all over the world, looking at art that's a million years old, until I get back to the pension late one night and there's the nice Midwestern boyfriend sitting on the steps with a backpack and a flower. "I crossed the ocean for you," he said. That night was my first time. It was really, really perfect. Except now, 2.5 months later, I'm sitting in a bathroom stall in an $8 a night hostel, the kind with 50 bunk beds in a single room and a bathroom like some high school gym. Row of sinks, row of showers, row of stalls. I locked myself in the last one up against the wall and peed on the stick. Now all there is to do is wait. 7:26 and 5 seconds, 7:26 and 10 seconds. It smells in here. 15, the fluorescent lights are buzzing, 20. From the hall I can hear voices, but I don't recognize the language, 25, 26, 27, and never in my life have I felt this alone. 7:26 and 30 seconds. I don't even know how to find an English-speaking doctor, 40, 41, 42, let alone get it taken care of, 44. Can you even do that in a Catholic country? And I realize that keeping it never once entered my head. 7:27. I got the pregnancy test from Janine, a girl in my American study abroad program who'd brought a 10-pack in her suitcase. "It's Italy," she'd said. "All you do in Italy is have sex." She's the one who told me to send my nice Midwestern boyfriend home back across the ocean so I'd be free to enjoy the culture. But I couldn't. I love him. I'm 18. The world is at my feet, a red carpet spread out before me, 7:27 and 8 seconds, 9 seconds, 10, 11. When I told the nice Midwestern boyfriend I was late, he said, "For what?" When I said, late, he didn't say anything. And then he got up, and without even looking at me, he went into the bathroom and turned on the shower. "Aren't we going to talk?" I said, following him. He was standing fully dressed under the faucet. He hadn't pulled the curtain, so water was spraying everywhere. His eyes were shut tight. His clothes were hanging, drenched and heavy, pulling him down like he was sinking. And I thought then that if he couldn't hold himself together, how was he ever going to hold on to me? 7:28. I left the apartment, wandering those streets till I found this hostel with its hidden bathroom stall, horrible fluorescent lights, no familiar faces. 10, 9, 8, and I peed on the stick. 7:06, I am so stupid. 5:04, please, I think, please. 2:01, and all that's left to do is look.
That was so cool. Hi, everybody. My name's Kaveh Akbar. I guess in keeping with that, I have a new poem called Ultrasound. Ultrasound. My father is tying concertina wire around his garden, which is now all but ruined by squirrels, deer, and worst of all, rabbits with cucumber seeds stuck to their tails. I am an apex predator. My father is an apex predator. God makes us in pairs. My mother searches the lawn for four-leaf clovers, pinning them to a scrapbook, pinning moments to time. She gives each clover a name. Buck comes onto porch and hospital note from Kaveh. While she makes tea inside, I search the house for a lighter and can't even find matches. What I miss most about winter is the brightness of winter. Summer's all foggy and wet. My mother hovers in the kitchen like a strange tune. She is out of saffron and has no money for more. She weeps over her bleach white rice until my father comes in, cracks an egg over the plate, bursts the yolk, says, see, says, yellow. My mother smiles so big and sad, she wrinkles into the future where my eyes are yellow again. Maybe from the yolk, maybe something else. My fur is coming in so thick, my mother would squeal with pride if she could see it. When she was pregnant, I kicked so hard, so often, she could barely sleep. Staying up all night, she thought she must be full of bunnies. That's a new one. And I'm just going to read one more poem. This is called, Do You Speak Persian? Some days we can see Venus in mid-afternoon. Then at night, stars separated by billions of miles. Light traveling years to die in the back of an eye. Is there a vocabulary for this? One to make dailiness amplify and not diminish wonder. I've been so careless with the words I already have. I don't remember how to say home in my first language, or lonely, or light. I remember only the Lambrat Tangshode. I miss you, and Shabakhe. Good night. How's school going, Kaveh June? The Lambrat Tangshode. Are you still drinking? Shabakhe. For so long, every step I've taken has been from one tongue to another. To order the world, I need, you need, he, she, it needs. The rest left to a hungry jackal in the back of my brain. Right now, our moon looks like a pale cabbage rose. The Lambrat Tangshode. We are forever folding into the night. Shabakhe.
I want to just keep listening to them. My book is also sort of about pregnancy and childbirth, in that it's basically a cautionary tale for those of you thinking about having children. The possible subtitle for both of my books are All the Things You Hope Never to Read About Your Child. I guess I will just say, since this is a panel about memoir, that I like to read this passage because I thought for a long time, and maybe you guys can relate to this a little bit, that once you wrote about something, especially as nonfiction, you had to be done with it. Kind of like how you feel after you've been talking about something in therapy for 10 years, like you get 86'd. But fortunately or unfortunately, that's not how it works. And so, you know, I wrote a whole book about the things in this passage, and then I felt like I couldn't talk about those things anymore, but then they kept intruding on this, my second book. And so this passage I'm going to read is actually a rewrite of a scene that appeared in my first book with a really different interpretation. In my last year of college, I took a job as a dominatrix. At work, I dressed in nurse uniforms and police uniforms and fishnets and corsets like a saloon prostitute in an old Western. Men paid me to be a mother, a maid, a customs officer, a nurse, a sadist. Sometimes they paid to hurt me. They paid to want. Doctors, lawyers, janitors, teachers, politicians, husbands, soldiers, holy men and criminals, they brought it to me. They begged. They crawled across floors. They wept. They grasped at my ankles and howled with hunger. They were ecstatic with want, sainted with want, bodies writhing and cringing, burning up on pyres of want, grasping at the wet wick of my body. When I was 22, I saw a woman suspended from a ceiling by hooks dug through the flesh of her back. We were at a party in Manhattan. She went by the name Lola and I Justine, my namesake, the Marquis de Sade's famous submissive heroine. In a rubber dress and stilettos, I stood on a staircase of a warehouse in Chelsea and tilted my head back. Lola's eyes at half-mast, her face was beatific, body glittering with makeup and pearly sweat. The stainless steel hooks gathered and lifted the skin over her shoulder blades in two mounds. All of her hung from those two handfuls of flesh. The puncture wounds wept, but Lola didn't. Her body glowed with pain, as if electrified, as if Electra, brilliant with relief, with glory, with revenge, with catharticos. She was beautiful. I looked up at her and I imagined my younger self at 11 or 12 years old, standing beside me on that staircase, all those leathered bodies writhing below us. Look, I imagined saying to that girl. Later, when I remembered this, I understood it as a desire to annihilate my own innocence. I had conjured the child in me at her most hurting age, and I showed her something shocking, incomprehensible. I wanted to break that innocence so that she would never be shocked again. Now, I think different. It was a tender impulse, not a violent one, and what I showed her was not incomprehensible. I don't know what hoisted Lola up to those rafters, but I know that she chose it. I know that she glowed like a planet, radiated light and gravity, colors like cosmic gases colliding. When they lowered her, she was just a woman. Her face, slick with sweat, was softer than I'd ever seen it, as if she'd just been born. Black hair wet against her forehead, she smiled and touched my face with her hot hand. The Catholic monks of Opus Dei, like their 13th century predecessors, practiced self-flagellation in prayer. In India, Pakistan, Iraq, and Iran, some Shiites march in parades, practicing their versions, sometimes with knives, blades, and chains. In Chinese medicine, coins are dragged across the body until blood rises to the surface in great striping hickeys. This treatment is believed to restore the body's balance. In this country, some teenage girls cut themselves with knives and scissors, and few of them describe the urge as one to punish. By the time I looked up at Lola, I had spent hours under tattoo guns, had slid poison needles into my arms, had shoved my own hand down my throat, had flung my body at so many perilous things, but I had never wanted to die. What I mean is, the difference between what is holy and what is pathological is sometimes a matter of fashion. What I mean is, maybe I already knew that my own healing would never look like a laying of hands, not the gentle kind. Maybe I wanted to spare that girl the extra hell of believing she was broken. We are all broken, and repair often hurts, and the ways we find to fix ourselves do not always look like fixing. Sometimes they fail, but they are never wrong. Thanks.
Thank you all. That was, you can see why I'm a fangirl, right? I think where that left off is actually a pretty good place to start. Let's talk a little about healing through writing, because I think that all three of you write about this and also are doing it. Megan, Shameless plug here, has an interview coming out on Monday morning at the Rumpus. And in that interview, you say that your book was an answer about what do I do with my fear. And so I'm thinking of how telling these stories, writing these poems, what does that do to you, for you? Why do you do that? Yeah, there's a lot of questions there. So pick one. And run with it.
You know, I get asked a lot or commented a lot, as I'm sure both of my fellow panelists do. I get called brave a lot. And I think the assumption, and this is an intuitive assumption, is that if you write about very personal things, you're very open and willing to share and comfortable talking about such things. But for me and for a lot of writers I know who are really vulnerable on the page, it's actually the opposite. I mostly write about things because I can't yet speak about them. And so ironically, sort of the first time I've spoken aloud about a lot of my experiences, it has been on panels like this. I mean, this is the end of my book tour, so that's not true right now. But I am by nature, I'm a really secretive person. I'm a very private person. I have an instinct for shame. And as many of us do, and I don't like to bear my wounds, right? And so writing for me, one of the epigraphs of this book is a quote by Winnicott that was, "It is a joy to be hidden and it is a disaster not to be found." And if that just made you both cringe and feel sort of discovered, then you should probably read these books. but for me, I sort of knew before I wrote any kind of memoir that that I needed to be found, and I was incapable of exposing myself to other people. And so for me, writing, in addition to many other things, is a space where I can speak things to myself and practice finding words for them so that I might then be able to share that with other people, right? I'll stop there.
No, that was so beautiful and kind of echoes everything that I could say. I'll say, too, that for me, a poem is a site for meaning making. And so when I am really, really struggling to make meaning, as was the case in the writing of this book, of my life and trying to figure out how to be a normal human person who does normal human person things, I went to the poems. The poems were where I kind of went to figure that out. And in order for it to be useful in that way, you have to bring the entirety of yourself. You can't partition off sections. You can't say, I'm not going to talk about this, because then the poem becomes impotent, right? It becomes, it loses its ability to be useful to you as a site for meaning making. If you have a section of yourself that's walled off from the poem. I think that a thing that's very liberating for me too is that I don't feel any sort of anxiety or compulsion to have to publish everything that I write. I have huge, huge quantities of poetry that I'll never ever publish that I wrote for myself that was useful for me, but that aren't necessarily stories that need to be told at a public level, or, you know, aren't necessarily my stories to tell that help me, you know, that's a decision that I can make after the poem is written. The poem is always, I preserve the sanctity of the space of the poem by not walling anything off, but the decision to publish a poem and the decision to write a poem are two very, very different conversations for me.
I just have to share that Melissa once gave me, as a piece of writing advice, that exact advice that I should write and not worry about who's going to read it and if I'm ever going to share it with anyone. So I think that's really a key kind of truth here.
Yeah, I would say the same thing. I think that this is like piggybacking on that. I think that there's a, for me, there's a difference between the practice of writing and the choice of if and when and how to share it. Most of what I make is me trying to figure it out, and mostly just to get it out of your body so you don't have to carry it around anymore. I'm in Chicago, and there the performance and the literary communities are tangled together in all sorts of really interesting ways. So most everything that I write before I publish it, I perform it in some kind of a way. That's really, like, back to that word brave, and I have like a complicated relationship with the word brave and with the word confession, and lots of language that can get really gendered also. But for me, it's really helped me with that, because when I, like, the conversation that we're having right now is just about right now. Well, I mean, it's being podcasted, so I guess that's worship. But it's in this moment, right? And so when I perform the stuff, I don't have to think about my dad in Alaska or my kid 10 years in the future, or all of my exes, or my mother, right? For any of you in the crowds who are like, how do you write that if your mother's gonna read? Like, I don't know, like, to perform it. When I just give it to a space like this, it's just about the moment, and I'm able to see what works and what can kind of start, what can start a dialogue. And I think that's what I'm really interested in with the work that I do want to put out in the world, is what can be a contribution, I think, to a dialogue that we're having. I write a lot about postpartum depression, and just the emails I get from people who are in that place, not just postpartum, but depression across the board, and not only the people who are experiencing it, but the men and women and people who love them and are trying to understand them as well too. And so then I get those emails, and then it becomes a dialogue, and then I want us to be able to talk more about it, because if we keep talking about it, then that's, I think, how we help with this shame thing.
Yeah. I think so much of what we can do as writers, one of our superpowers is to give voice to people who have either had their voices taken away or give voice to people who don't know how to have their voice be heard. And so I think in each of these books, we are trying to create a compassionate awareness about something. We are at a place in our lives when we are able to put these voices and these stories out into the world in a way that will create these kinds of dialogues you're talking about. I'm sure that you've gotten those emails too. I get emails, and there's real value in, if it is safe for you psychologically to do it, in being able to put your work out and create a kind of compassionate awareness for these conditions.
So you all just, I don't know if you know, mentioned the body. And I feel like in your work, the body is very present. And Megan, you talked about it in terms of performing and the body. And then I think Kaveh and Melissa, you both talked about getting things out of your body. Mm-hmm. But you're also writing about your body. And that's a very intimate and personal thing to do. When you do that, do you feel like you're kind of exposing yourself? Do you sort of separate yourself from your body? I'm kind of interested to hear how you see your body on the page as you're writing it.
I'll say that, and this is kind of the same answer, but for me, I mean, I often think of writing as this kind of external mill for psychological and emotional processing for me, because left to my own devices, I tend towards addiction, dissociation, detachment, lying. And so for me, writing, because it's a space that is not subject, and this goes back to what Kaveh was saying, it's a space that for me, the way that I create the writing space and the way that it's been really sort of gifted to me by my own mind is that it is not subject to the emotional needs or perceptions of other people, which I feel profoundly obligated to take care of and control in my life. And so, by nature, I mean. And so, the writing space becomes this place where almost all of the integration that's ever happened for me has happened through writing.
How do you do that? How do you keep the audience and your readers from
intruding
on that?
It's really a way that I've sort of hacked my own consciousness, because I just tend towards sort of compartmentalization and detachment. Like, there really is a way. I also think that early on, like, my first book was like, it really was like everything you never should talk about in public if you ever want to have a job or a relationship with anyone, or like, you know? And so I think, like, you know, you can't just, if you want to write a story, am I going to say this into the microphone? Yes. If you want a story in which you poop on someone in the story, like, that happened in my first, I mean, maybe it didn't even need to be in there, but it was, and just like everything I could never ever say out loud, that I had never even said to my therapist out loud, I really just was like, okay, it was like what Kaveh was saying, and what Megan was saying, where I was like, I have to make a promise to myself that I never have to show this to anyone, you know, and I think I make that promise before I write anything ever, or else I could never write the things I do. And yet, I honestly, you know, people say this a lot, and maybe it's true for all of us. I can say for me that it is literally true that, like, writing has saved my life. Like, I really believe that I'd probably be dead of, like, heroin addiction or bad relationships or all of those things that I'm trying to work against in my own nature. And so the stakes feel very, very high for me. Like, I have to make that promise to myself so that I can work this stuff out, because I have never in my life figured anything out in my own mind. Like, I cannot heal myself in my thoughts. Like, it goes south immediately.
Yeah, that was extraordinarily well put, and I'm not going to be able to say anything as articulate or useful as that. But I'll say that my book is an addiction recovery narrative. It's my addiction recovery narrative. So when I began writing it, I was very much learning how to be a new person. I was, Yeats talks about, you know, being this beautiful eternal soul strapped to a dying animal, and that's what I felt like. I was strapped to this dying animal. And I was trying to figure out how to be a new thing. And, you know, I was still inhabiting the same architecture that the old thing had sort of lived in and kind of wrecked, you know. Like, he didn't get a security deposit back. And so the poem was a space for me to go to and kind of figure that out. And I think that it was kind of a safe place for me to put my body, too. Like, it was a thing where... when I literally didn't know what to do with these new extra 16 hours that I had in every day. And so a poem, you know, reading or writing was just a place to put myself. It was, you know, like a holding cell. It was my padded room. And I think that in that way, there's a very real sense in which my addictions kind of didn't go anywhere necessarily. They just kind of sublimated, you know. They just kind of went from chemical into literary, right? Like, I don't pursue this thing with any less ferocity than I pursued the last thing. I'm not any less obsessed with it or compulsive about it. It's just this thing, you know, isn't killing me.
I think with this book in particular, so it's all personal essays. They're all about fear. I turned it in the summer of 2016, and then I got all my editorial notes, and so I did all the final rewrites during the lead up to the 2016 election. Right, like, I think just like even letting that sit in my head for a minute. So I think back to what you were saying, like, you don't write it and then it's solved. You know, we don't heal by, I take this one pill and then I'm fine. Or I went to this one therapy appointment, and then shazam, it's great. Like, I think of this as an ongoing process, and this is part of the process of making the work, right? Like, I made all of these essays about, you know, our house caught on fire, and we had 5 minutes to get the baby out, and then, like, all this depression stuff, and my dad keeps having heart attacks on mountains, and he's a big game hunter in Alaska, and he keeps going up on mountains all the time, and, like, what do you do with all of that fear, right? So I was trying to put all of that fear out, and then it was out, and then, you know what, now I have a whole lot of more shit of fear happening in the world, right? And the stakes feel higher, and so it's not that, you know, since I've been touring with the book, it's all like, well, now do you understand, like, do you understand, and you, like, moved past it. It's like, are you kidding? Like, has anybody been on Twitter? And you know, and so it all feels like it's constantly happening, and that is so connected to the body. We're carrying all of it. I've been so tense this week. Like, I want to launch myself off the roof. I'm not, but you know, like that, or more appropriately, like, throw my laptop into the sea or something. And that's in here. And so putting it out and trying to be honest about what this feels like and what the source is feels very important right now. And I think, kind of jumping off of that, reading many, many other voices who are experiencing this in different ways, because I think the goal of personal work is to put it out into the world in a way that it will matter to other people. And if I'm just doing that and not taking it back in and reading what other people who are going through, you know, multiple intersecting identities and that's what matters. So I think for my writers in the room, like, what are we reading? If I'm allowed to give you an assignment, I don't know if I'm like, can I give you all homework? Like, go home and look at your bookshelf. Who is on your bookshelf? Do they all look like you? Are they all the same gender as you? Do they all have the same background, right? Because our fears and the things that we need to heal from and understand are all so different. And if we're gonna make this better, we have to listen.
Okay, I'm just going to ask a couple more questions, and then I'm going to toss the questions out to you guys. You just brought up the political landscape that we're living in, which I think is an unavoidable question for me to ask you guys. Megan, I think you're the only one whose book came out late enough that you were able to kind of edit some stuff in there about what's going on right now. But I know you all to be very politically minded and, you know, active kind of members of the literary community. And I'm wondering if you could just talk a little, I'm not wondering how, I kind of know how. I'm wondering if you could talk a little about how the fact that Donald Trump is our president has or hasn't affected your writing process and your feelings about writing, and also the way you teach. You're all teachers, and I feel like this must come into the classroom.
I think of poetry as this really, really intensely efficient empathy delivery mechanism, right? Where, you know, in the space of 14 lines, you have access to somebody's unprecedented experience that is completely unlike your own. You know, nobody, no two people in this room have, you know, lived experiences that are even remotely similar. And so when you write a poem that's sort of, that's language shining through the prism of your singular unprecedented experience, and then whatever light comes through gets put on the page, right? So when we go into that and we access that, it's like taking your empathy pill for the day, right? And so I think that poetry is infinitely potent in that way, specifically. I'll also say, too, that, you know, I'm speaking to poetry, and I'm interested to hear, but I'll also say, too, that what poetry asks us to do is slow down, right? It asks us to slow down and think about the materiality of language, and I think that one of the great weapons used against critical thinking right now in 2017 is a massive overwhelm of meaningless argle bargle, and just like just doublespeak and you know just this overwhelm of language that means nothing, and it's meant to dull you. It's pointed. It's mercenary, and it's meant to stop you from thinking and from being critical. And what poetry asks us to do is to slow down our metabolization of language and think about our consumption of language. So I think in this way, it's infinitely potent. Just, you know, even aside from content matter, just the act of reading a poem, it tightens those muscles in your brain, you know, and it makes you think about language, and it makes you think about the way that you're consuming and metabolizing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I would completely second all, I mean, that's really the only thing to be said about it. And yet, I don't, you know, like, I think I've been asked this question so many times, having a book coming out after the election, about sort of like, how do you manage it? And this, of course, is not your question, Marissa, but sometimes I feel like the question I'm really being asked is like, how do you rationalize writing memoir when all of this is happening? Like, how do you avoid how trivial it is?
I just saw you answer, or read you answer a question.
And actually, like, nothing about the way that I feel about teaching or writing it has changed. If anything, the ante has been upped, you know, because of exactly what Kaveh said, that it is an exercise in empathy, both for me and for my students. And I have always felt so incredibly grateful that this is what I teach, like, creative writing in general, specifically memoir, because it, you know, I've... people who are not writers who don't teach writing often say, like, well, how do you, don't you get tired because your students are not all going to be writers? To which I say, yes, but they're all going to be humans for the rest of their lives. And teaching writing is just a trick. Like, I'm just tricking them into taking humanity classes, right? Into examining the humanity of other people. And, you know, I think particularly for me, because I teach at a place where my students are likely not ever going to be introduced to work, to the work that I introduce to them, you know, and all, even the method in which I teach, like, I have long been teaching syllabi that is all writers of color, queer writers, all women. My students don't even notice. They take for granted what I give them the same way that I did in my early education when it was all dead white straight guys, you know, right. And so... I don't know. I feel incredibly grateful and lucky to already have a life that is built around exactly what I think is the best use of my energy in this moment in America.
It's not really possible for me to kind of, I think, separate my writing and my teaching, generally speaking, and like to complete a triangle, my politics. I mean, I've been teaching creative writing in Chicago for 20 years. I'm reading the work of people who are young and Black, people who are young and queer, people who are young and women and growing up in this city. And so that affects everything that I do. It affects how I see the world, right? And I think if we are constantly listening, which that's the word, to me that's teaching creative writing as well too. That's teaching creative reading, right? If we're constantly listening, we can't help but be changed and moved and want to step up to the plate when we can. Because sometimes people can't step up to the plate, right? There was a long time in my life when I was on the ground and I needed to get myself together, right? And I'm here now. And so now I can step up to the plate, and some other people need to take care of themselves or take care of their family or take care of their healing. And so we need each other. Like we, the three of us, the four of us need all of you as well in your work. And so to me, it's all really tangled together. But really specifically, I think how it's changed for me, it is upping the ante for sure. And I feel a little bit like that, kind of what I talked about before, like that kind of private, messy space where I can just try out work and then put it into the world if it feels right. There's another layer to this, which is kind of like when something happens that feels very urgent that I think that I can make a contribution. That's the question that I'm always trying to ask myself. Does this need to be said? Does it need to be said by me? Does it need to be said by me right now? So say, for example, the day after the election, I called my doctor to see if I could get early replacement on my IUD because I was afraid of what healthcare was going to look like in 2019 for women. And TMI, welcome to my business, people here at the panel. And it was, you know, and I am a person who had health insurance at that time, and I'm a person who has resources, and still, like, just getting that done was a crazy mess, right? And it didn't occur to me to write about it until 6 months later when we lost the birth control mandate in the Affordable Health Care Act. And so is me writing about my body, it is political. It is political. Like me trying to protect my body is now a political conversation. So, and it's always been a political conversation, but it feels more urgent. It feels really urgent right now. You know, so in my nice little private writing process, like when we lost the mandate, it was like, I have some things to say about that. and I am a person who can say it right now. So, because I had this whole weird story, so.
Okay, thank you guys for being brilliant human beings. I am sure that this room has questions for you, and we want to take them. Do we have a mic for the audience? No. Okay, so I will repeat your questions if we can't hear them. Yes, go ahead.
You talked about both like protecting the space to create and being politically engaged.
I would love to say something brilliant and genius about this. I feel like... I feel like I'm a little bit of a mess with it right now. I want to be really transparent about that. Like I none of us have all the answers to any of these things at all. A thing that's been really really helpful for me this year is that I have a child, a 9-year-old child, and so and you know, everybody parents in their own way, but he and I talk about what is happening in the world and I tell him the truth, right? And so to try to figure out age-appropriate ways to have these conversations has been really useful for me. Like earlier you talked about how a poem slows something down. So these conversations have helped me slow down what is happening and to really try to find the language that kind of lands in, here's what is happening, here is what we can do to make things better. Have any of y'all seen that Mr. Rogers thing about the helpers? Do you know what I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. It's like Mr. Rogers did this whole thing. Yeah, like when there's horrible things happen in the world, we have to look for the helpers. And I was in Vegas a few weeks. I was in your city a few weeks ago. Hi. And so to be there with that community and there's a couple of essays in the book about shootings and guns, and I grew up with guns, and my father was in a school shooting, and so this is very close to me, what your community recently went through. And that was the thing that I kept seeing when I was watching what was happening in Vegas, was all of the helpers and how all of those people, how that community stood up for one another. So those are the conversations that I'm trying to have with my kid, is how can we be a helper, right? And so to say that to a child, and then have to translate that in my head about what that means for me as a grown-up. Like, what are things that I can actually do? It would be, my personality is such, it would be very easy for me to spiral with a lot of what's happening in the world right now, and I do when I can. But then to flip it back to, what are actual practical things that I can do to make this better for other people? Sometimes straight up, that means money. If you are a person in this room and you have money to kick around, where are places and people who can have it? That their lives can be better because of it. But sometimes it means our time, and sometimes it means our work, and sometimes it means how we help individuals, but other times it means how we protect ourselves, right? I mean, if all of your, the young people that you're working with are going through these heavy things, you also get to protect yourself.
We have a question up there. Yes, you.
It's often to not just try and portray yourself, but also portray other folks in your life or other how to sort of navigate those boundaries, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Navigating the boundaries about writing about other people.
I could write a whole book about this, and yet I wouldn't because I don't want to have those conversations with my family again.
But did you have those conversations?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a great question, and I think it's like the number one question for a lot of people, because it is impossible. Like, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but it is impossible to write about the biggest events and transformations in your own life without implicating other people. You cannot do it. Transformation does not happen in a vacuum. Trauma doesn't happen in a vacuum. None of it does, right? So, I mean, for me, I mean, it sounds like the question was about sort of navigating that in terms of my own choices in my work, which is separate also from sort of, I mean, I don't know, maybe not. What I do is a few things, and it has changed over the two books that I've written. The first one was much more about me, and so it didn't feel as heavy, even though it was really intense to talk about it with my family. The second book is very much about my family, about my ex, about my younger brother, who had a psychotic break when he was 18, and it was one of the things I thought I would never write about. And it's really, we went through one of the most intense experiences of my life, just processing me having written that essay. And the first thing I will say to you is, I don't know, you have to sort of measure the, if you want to continue to have a relationship with the person that you're implicating in your story, be ready to have that conversation, mm-hmm. and stay in it, mm-hmm. until everything's been said, you know? And I had that conversation with my brother, and one of the things, and this changed for me with this book, I always sort of felt like it was my prerogative, it was my right, it's my story too, right? But I had also never written something that was truly sort of a bigger story for the other person than it was for me, you know? It was like one of the biggest events of his life, and it was a big event in my life, but it was, you know? And what I came to is that, sorry, I'm finding my words, I haven't really talked about this publicly, but is that it's not f***ing fair. It's really not. Like, we got to a point in the conversation where it was like, it's not fair that I happen to be the writer in the family. You know? And I don't think that means that I'm not allowed to tell stories, but I think it means that I have to take responsibility for what that means. And that means that I have to accept how it affects my relationships. It means that I have to measure every sentence that I put on the page against my love and the potential for wounding a person I love more than anyone else in the world, you know? Like, it is a tremendous responsibility to write stories that are also other people's stories. And I don't think that means we're not allowed to do it, but I think we should be as present with that reality as possible.
Mm-hmm. She's written about exactly this in the book, mm-hmm. Which is it's a fascinating path. happened.
Yeah, I actually write in this book about my dad's response to my first book. I will say this, and I think it's important to say this, that I have closer and deeper and more complex and more intimate relationships with everyone that I love most as a result of writing these stories. It has been one of the hardest, most transformative experiences of my life, going through the process of having written the book with those people. And I have showed up for those interactions, which doesn't mean that I've, you know, done everything that people have asked me to do or taken things out when they've asked me to, but I've shown up for it.
Yeah, I would agree with all of that. And I think that the thing that I would add is, we talk a lot about you. I love how you worded it, that the poem is a efficient empathy. What did you say?
Delivery
mechanism. I think the process, hopefully, if we're really doing it right, the process of writing can make us more empathetic to these individuals as well, too, right? Like, like sometimes when I sit down and I'm just writing for myself, like I will bash the hell out of people. I need to get rid of some of that. But that's not going to go out into the world. Right, that's an immediate reaction, an immediate response, like that's the rage of it. And then I make some choices, and then I try to really look at what it is that I'm saying, and I try to imagine it from their perspective, and my hope is that is helping my humanity in some kind of a way, and I think that that's a worthy goal. If I can also take the question out of the intensity of subject matter and just to a craft level, you're probably going to get a lot of people saying to you, "That's not how it happened. It didn't happen that way." And I think that's another interesting choice as a memoirist. Like I sent the galley of this book to my dad, and he called it. He called me and he said, "Do you still have time to change things?" And I was like, "Oh my god!" And I was nervous that I'd pushed something too far, or and I was ready to show up for the conversations. And he was like, "On page 40, you had me carrying the kind of gun that I would use to kill a Dall sheep, but you have me going after a partridge. And so, and then you have a wood burning stove in the boat, and then in the boat you don't burn wood because of." And he's listing all these factual things, and
it's so true.
And I was like, "Okay, listen, I'm gonna process this. I'm gonna call you back." And then I called him back, and I was like, "Okay, here's the thing, I will change these details because I wrote an essay about how much I love you," right? And I don't want you to sit and read that essay and flinch every time with those little tiny details. But here's the thing, I am right and you are wrong. I'm gonna change it. Because if I were writing a factual book from the point of view of a hunter in Alaska, then those details would really matter. But I am writing it from the place of his Chicago daughter imagining him. Right, and so to me, there needs to be just as much as there is a responsibility to other people, there's also a responsibility to how we remember and how we see and how we imagine this in the craft of it, mm-hmm. And the details that I included were the details that I had seen. Right, so all this gets really meta and complicated, and we're talking about a stove on a boat, right? But it, but. Anyway, obviously, I put a lot of time and bourbon into thinking about this.
Yeah, and
we have 1 minute left. Do we want to squeeze in one last question, or does anyone have a question? Lightning question. Who's got a quick question?
Oh, you got a hand?
Yeah. Okay. Yep. That's a great lightning question.
That is a great lightning question.
So who are your favorite writers? Who do you appreciate?
I'm going to make a plug, and I'm going to be candid and admit that this is my girlfriend, but she also happens to be a genius. And her book is called Bestiary, Danica Kelly. She's a poet.
It's a beautiful book.
It's a really beautiful book. I totally, as a writer, that's actually how we met, is that I read her book and was like, "You're a genius."
I'll also recommend Danica's book. It's incredible. She's an actual genius with a capital A, capital G. But for the sake of adding people to the conversation, I would also say that Jenny Offal is really, really wonderful. If you're interested in memoir, I think that she's done some really, really fascinating things with the medium. I'll also say that Frank Bidart's New Collected is it's like a holy object, you know what I mean? Like I treat it like a holy object. And it is like a book that is about desire and woundedness, and it tells, I mean, it's just, it's magisterial.
This is a great place to end it on. Samantha Irby, I-R-B-Y, yes. Is the name that you want.
Yes.
Her newest collection is called We Are Never Meeting in Real Life. Public service announcement. I made the mistake of reading that book in public. It is the funniest thing that I've ever read in my life. I don't know if you all know Chicago. I started reading it on the L train at Lake, and then I was going to Loyola, so it's about an hour north. Somewhere I was laughing so hard that I peed on the train. I peed on the train, and so I was on the train way too long for an adult woman to be sitting. Right. And so again, TMI and the panel on there's a cat on the cover.
Thank you all so much for coming. Thank you, Melissa, Kaveh, and Megan.
That was a conversation between poets Keveh Akbar, Melissa Phoebos, and Megan Steelstra from our book festival in November 2017. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.